Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. But I say unto you that Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Now if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? Oh, I mean, it sounds lovely read in church. But what it says, everybody says, no, that's the Sermon on the Mount, and that's not practical. Nobody can do that. That may be for a few saints, but after all, in our practical life as practicing Christians in the modern world, we can't do that kind of thing. Well, isn't that funny? Why can't you do it? I mean, that's the real reason for saying it in the first place. Jesus said many very strange things. For example, in the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, how the Pharisee goes up into the front row and says how good he is, and that he's fulfilled all his obligations and paid the tithes. And then there's this publican who goes into the back and sits there and beats his breast and says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus says, now that man was the right man. He was justified. But the moment he's told that story, everybody creeps into the back row and says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And they're all in the front row again. Nobody can do it, you see. That's why the story is told. In the same way, he says, take no thought for the morrow. Stop being anxious, like going to a psychiatrist. And he says to you, oh, don't worry me. Stop being nervous. Can you? See, nobody can. And also they find out, you see, that really in the end, nobody can be God. Nobody can make life any better by being responsible about it. Because whatever you gain in that direction, you lose at the same time. By being responsible, we've created civilization. Medicine, care of the poor, everything. But what a headache the thing has become. As we solve all our problems, we make more problems. Every problem you solve gives you 10 new problems. I'm not saying don't do that, but don't think you're going to get anywhere by doing that. That's one way of arranging it. That's one kind of dance you can have, is to improve everything and have technology. But it doesn't really solve anything. And it's only in the moment you see, when you fully understand that your situation as a human being is completely insoluble, that there is no answer, and that you give up looking for the answer, that's nirvana. And that's how Buddhism works. A dialogue, the beginning of which is not necessarily at all the same thing as the end. The reason is that the discovery which constitutes the foundation of Buddhism, the experience of awakening, can't be stated. Or at least, if it can be stated, it can't be stated in such a way that the mere statement will communicate the experience to somebody else. The experience itself is the culmination of an adventure. And one has to go through that adventure in order to come to it. I've sometimes tried to describe this adventure as a reductio ad absurdum of one's own false views, through a process wherein the teacher makes you act consistently upon your false views so that you come to find out experimentally that they are false. And indeed, one might say, Buddhism has nothing to teach, nothing whatever. All it has to do is to get rid of illusions. And then the content, the experience, happens when the illusions are gone, just like the sun comes out when the clouds go away. But if you try to manufacture the sun before the clouds have gone away, you see what I mean? And you paint the sun on this side of the clouds, it's not the real sun. So in this way, the speculation as such, ideation as such, does not lead to the awakening experience. So then, this was the first point then, that it's a dialogue, and from the statements about Buddhism that you can read in books, you will discover only the opening phases of the dialogue. One of the methods that's used in this respect, people say, now, Buddhism teaches that all things are subject to change. Nothing is permanent. Now, that isn't exactly what Buddhism teaches. A more subtle scholar will tell you that the Buddha taught that the world is impermanent in order to counteract the wrong view that it's permanent. And Buddhist teachers always work in oppositions. If a person asks you a question about philosophical matters, you should reply in terms of everyday matters. What is the fundamental principle of Buddhism? I have just finished washing the saucepans. Or the other way round, if a person asks you a worldly question, you answer with a philosophical one. Please will you pass me the knife? And so the teacher passes it blade first. Please, I want the other end. What would you do with the other end? You see? Here the metaphysics comes in answer to the practical question. And so when R.H. Blythe, who's a great Zen student, was asked by some students, do you believe in God? He replied, if you do, I don't. If you don't, I do. So, when anything then is taught, it's taught in order to counteract something. You see, the Buddha taught that there was no self. And scholars have debated eternally whether he meant there was no ego in the sense of the superficial I centered on consciousness alone, or whether he taught that there is no self in the more classical Hindu sense of the Atman, that is to say, the ultimate self, the divine final reality which is in everybody, which is the root and ground of all consciousness everywhere. And some people, you see, have thought that he denied that. Well, he may very well have done so. But with the idea, you see, of correcting something, if you see a person believes that his basic self is divine and eternal and beyond all vicissitude, he may be believing that for very wrong reasons. He may be believing in it as something to cling to give him a sense of security. But so long as you have a sense of security and you feel safe, you haven't got the point. Because it means you're still relying on something. And a Buddha is a man who doesn't depend on anything. Not because he's so tough and he's so strong. When you get a tough guy who says, I'm not afraid of anything, you try him out and you'll soon find he has limits. Everybody has his price, if you try hard enough. It isn't, you see, a question of being strong in the sense of tough. It's a question of knowing very clearly that there isn't anything to depend on. So you don't depend on things anymore. The only thing to depend on is what you really are. But that's not something you can hang on to, you see. You can't catch hold of that. You don't need to. The sun doesn't need to shine a light on the sun. So by the exploration of the dialectic, the teacher, by talking this way and talking that way, completely undermines you That is to say, he digs out all the dirt from underneath you. And you drop, or think you do, because you're used to having the earth there. But when you're in fully in empty space, there's nowhere to drop. That's why people get such a marvelous feeling when they go skin diving and they get down below 30 feet or so and start to lose all sense of weight. Or when astronauts go out and start to lose weight in the middle of their space bubbles. You know what's going to happen? All those boys are going to get out there and they're not going to want to come back. This is just great. That's what happens to skin divers, you see. They didn't have automatic controls on those things. They'd be not too certain of getting the man back. Because when people go down skin diving and they stay down too long, so you have to have a watch with you and or someone with a string on you or something to know exactly when you've got to make the trip back. You may have oxygen to last you a long time, but you're going to go out of your mind because you will suddenly realize that nothing matters, that everything is okay. I mean, so what? Supposing I do die. And people take off their oxygen masks and present it to a fish. Say, have a drag. They're so happy, you see. So you know the famous story when Suzuki was asked, what is it like to have Satori? He said, well, it's just like ordinary everyday experience, except about 2 inches off the ground. So there is this peculiar thing, a sense of, you might say, weightlessness. But you mustn't interpret that too literally. Some people interpret it so literally that they believe great mystics levitate. I remember when I was a little boy, there was a famous dean in England. His name was Ralph W. Inge, or Ing. Ing, I think it's pronounced. And he wrote many books on Plotinus and mysticism. And one day he came to Canterbury Cathedral and was sitting in the choir stall, and I was sitting right near him. And I noticed that all the time he was doing this. He had a stick, you know. And but people said it was because he was always about to levitate. Had to keep himself pressed down. So that levitation, you see, just is something in mystical experience, like a sense of luminosity or a sense of transparency. It's very common. There are two visions of the world, you see, that painters have had in history. There's the vision of, let's say, in our own Western history, the vision of Giotto or Fra Angelico and the vision of Rembrandt. You see, Rembrandt is full of shadows, whereas the other painters are full of luminosity. And then you can get some painters who are not only full of shadows, but their paintings look as if they were all drawn just outside a Foster's freeze. You know what a Foster's freeze is? I don't know if you have them on the East Coast, but you probably have the equivalent. They're places where they sell ice cream custard. And they sell them from a glass box, which is all lit inside with fluorescent light. It's absolutely blue and cold. And the customers all stand outside the glass box. And on a chilly night, yeah, there you see them, all under this ghastly blue light, eating ice cream cones. And the men serve it to them through little windows, like a theater ticket box. And how people can go, that's my idea of one of the cold hells. But they do, and so there are some paintings, some visions of the world that look as if they're seen under that light, so that there is no light within things. Now, when you see the other painter, he sees light in everything. Even shadows are full of color. You notice with Picasso's work how full of light it is. And that's because the vision of the world, of the mystic, is always full of light. Only it isn't quite literal light. It isn't as if everything was blazing. Or he may say that everything is transparent. And it doesn't mean that he can see through your body to the wall or the other person behind. It means that things are transparent because they're clear. It has become clear. A problem has disappeared that I thought was a real problem, and now it is clear. I can't tell you how it's clear, but it is. And that's what we're going to get to in finding out what thusness is. When things are seen in the state of thusness or suchness, they are clear. There is no further problem about them. They are what they are, and they do what they do. And if you can really penetrate that, as we shall go into it, you will see the mystery clear up. The mystery clears up when you get to the point that you don't know what questions to ask anymore. The questions have vanished. The problem has vanished. Now, aside from the fact that Buddhism is a method, is a dialogue, I explained too that it's a transformation of one's state of consciousness. That's what awakening means. That is to say, it is a transformation of the way you see things, almost, I could say, the way you sense them. And in this respect, I've often thought that the process of Buddhism is much more like ophthalmology than it's like religion. An ophthalmologist is a person who corrects your vision so that you see clearly. And so in exactly the same way, awakening is to see clearly. A transformation of consciousness. Be careful of the implications that that word may have, because it doesn't mean necessarily an ecstatic state of affairs, and it doesn't mean an unnatural or even strange state of affairs. I mean, you could imagine that if you put on blue glasses, you would for a while see everything looking blue. It isn't something like that at all. Or it isn't as if you saw everything in a different way, like you suddenly put on the eyes of a fly, you see, and suddenly everything became multiple. You saw this room and the people in it hundreds of times all at once. It isn't something like that. It's just that everything is the way it always was, except it has a completely different meaning. And there is a curious connection between the experience of this and the understanding of it. First of all, there are really three steps in this kind of understanding. You might say there is, in the first place, an intellectual comprehension, or the getting of an idea. And what sort of idea do I mean? Let's take, for example, the idea of a third dimension. To be aware of depth. If you look at things with one eye only, you see, you don't see depth. But if you look with two eyes, then the dimension of depth appears. And once you, though, have understood depth, though, you can see depth. For example, I don't look at things with two eyes at once. I look either with my left eye or with my right eye, and I don't have binocular vision. But I still see depth, because I understand it to be there, and as a result of understanding it to be there, I see it. If I understand clearly, I couldn't understand the nature of depth if I was just told, looking at things, that they have two dimensions. But if I make an exploration and I handle the thing, and I understand what a third dimension is, then I understand it more thoroughly. I'm quite clear about it. And then as a result of being clear about it, I see it. Now, in the same way, people did one time actually see, believe it or not, the crystal spheres in which the planets were supported. We would say, how did they see it if it was transparent? Well, they saw it. They knew it was up there. And it was there for all to see, because naturally you can always see through crystal. It's clear. You see, people really think like that. And they see things if they're hypnotized into seeing them. Now then, if you take the suggestion away, then they won't anymore. Or conversely, if you have the idea of a number system which is only one, two, three, many, nobody can see four things. They will see something that other people call four, but they won't see four, they will just see many. And four will be as many as five. They might begin then to have a concept of a little many and a big many, and a middle many. That's three again. They won't be able to get little many.